You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
Right now, go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. What a weekend it had been. The Unite the Right rallies. Nobody bothered to show up on the right. I was expecting hundreds. I was expecting thousands. I was expecting somebody. Not so much. And it's one of those things where you just got to go, not so much, not happening so much whatsoever. Counter protests, a couple thousand people showed up to shout them down and, well, to put them in their place. And that's a good thing. We'll talk about that today. Lots of stuff today. The prosecution wrapped up in the Manafort trial. Trump and the wacky Omarosa, just tons and tons of stuff that I want to get to. But first, on Friday, we had David Pakman on the show. He's a nationally syndicated radio host, does a TV program on free speech like we do. A decent guy. I like David. I've known him for years. And I thought we had a really good conversation. Got a little hung up on trade, you know, a little minor disagreement. And I had a bunch of people emailing me, you know, basically saying that I surrendered on trade and that I, you know, that I was wrong. Gee, all you care about is those jobs. I go, yeah, your point. And it got me to thinking over the weekend that we've been really brainwashed pretty well. I mean, you see the Walmart ads, you know, lower prices, live better. Really? I don't know that that's living better. Buying a bunch of cheap crap that's going to break in a couple of weeks. I don't know that that makes my life better. And, you know, virtually everyone who tried to take me to task on the trade issue, because there's part of me that says this is just a reflective, just a reaction to Trump did it. And I've said before, the blind squirrel finds a nut occasionally. And I think, you know, Trump was right on this. He stole the labor message. He knew what the white working class of this country wanted to hear. And needed to hear, and I think is the right direction for us to go. And he grabbed onto it. And nobody believed, if we have to relitigate 2016, nobody bought that Hillary was going to be against the TPP. Not even I bought it. Not even a little bit. And this is one of those things where you go, trade matters. And for me, someone who has spent, you know, a good portion of the years that I've been doing this, talking about the trade issue and making it a central tenet of what I, where I spend my attention, I've been calling for tariffs for a very long time because our trade deficit is completely out of whack. And the idea that the tariffs are the complete answer and it's going to solve is not what I'm saying. At some point, you have to use the carrot and the stick occasionally has to be used. And to put tariffs on, you begin to have the conversations. Now, what I think Trump should be doing differently, because my fear, and I've said this, anyone who listens to this program knows, that one of my great fears is that Trump is right in this and we need to have tariffs on Chinese goods to kind of level things out a little bit, is that he's doing it in such a just insane way, in such a backwards, just haphazard way, that I don't believe there's really a plan here, that he screws it up for all eternity. And maybe that's part of the plan. I don't understand why we're picking a fight with the Canadians. That doesn't make sense to me. I don't know why we're picking fights with our allies. We're generally somewhere in the ballpark when it comes to trade deficits with our allies. What we should be doing is reaching out to those allies who they themselves are being crushed by China and saying, look, we need to have more balanced trade. You need to get your people to be consuming more things or buying more of our products, so that there's some balance. But I kept getting this, and every time the email would come in, well, you just want me to pay more for stuff. And I go, well, what good is it? And this was basically my universal response. What good is it to have low prices if you don't have wages, if you don't have a job? What good is it that the widget or whatnot costs 3/4 of what it would cost if it were made here in the U.S. if you don't have the ability to afford it? And I started thinking about, some of the things that, and it was just a real quick kind of cursory thought of some of the things that I interact with on a daily basis that used to be owned by us, not anymore. I was thinking about taking the kids to a movie over the weekend. There's an AMC theater in our neighborhood. I was going, hey, we go to there. I forgot. They're owned by a Chinese company. The Chinese own them. Not even American movie cinema anymore. if you want to see a movie, Japanese own Sony. They've owned it for a long time. You just go down the list of all of the things that we used to take for granted. I mean, we have a TV, and I tried to find an American-made TV. Good luck. You've got Sony TVs are a South Korean company and Japanese company. You got LG, which is Chinese. You've got GE Appliances, which is Chinese. You can look at all of this stuff. Even something as simple as ice cream. Ben and Jerry's. Ben and freaking Jerry's. Ben and Jerry's owned by a Dutch company. Budweiser owned by a Belgian company. I mean, you can go down the list. 7-Eleven owned by a Japanese company. Gas station, Citgo, owned by Venezuela. Shell, owned by a Dutch company. BP, British Petroleum, owned by a British company. Trader Joe's, owned by a German company. Nestle, owned by a German company. Gerber, owned by a German company. Bayer, it is a German company. I mean, you go down the list of all these things that we go, some of that stuff's classic Americana. You think about the toys of the past, Mattel. You think about Huffy bicycles. You go down the list of all of these things that we grew up with, that you were made in factories in small towns all across this country. Gone. All of them. And I love when people say, we've lost 10 million jobs. I go, we didn't lose any jobs. We know exactly where they are. It's not like we were just walking down the road one day. I go, gee, where'd those jobs go? We know exactly where they are. They found their way to cheaper locales. And it's because of our trade policies. And it's because my theory has always been you have open free trade with similar countries that have similar standards of living. The UK, Germany, Canada, your top economic OECD countries. There you have open trade because your living standards are the same. In fact, in most of those countries, our living standard is pulling them down. We're pulling them down because we're trying to compete with desperate nations. We're trying to compete with countries that, use authoritarian means with poverty wages and lax environmental regulations and I'm not going to say no unions because we're breaking them here thanks to the Republican Party. But what you end up having is you end up having a country that had a strong, vibrant, prosperous middle class competing with desperation and poverty. And what do you think ended up happening? All of those guys sitting in the corner offices in the CEO suites across this country go, hey, you know, we could move that factory from that plant in Michigan where we're paying those guys 18 or 19 bucks an hour with health care and pensions and paid sick days and vacations and weekends off and eight-hour days and overtime after 40. We could take that and we could move it to, you know, somewhere in China where they're going to heavily subsidize us. And we're not going to have any problems with those workers because if they give us a problem, we'll just get rid of them, bring a whole bunch more in. And they'll work for a buck an hour, vacation, health care, pension, what? They don't have any of that. So you had all of these CEOs who were lining their pockets, moving these jobs. And this is one of the things that drives me insane. You know, you hear people say, well, the union made the company go out of business. The union forced the company out of the country because they asked for too much. And it's one of those things, every time I hear it, my head wants to explode, but I kind of hold it in because no union worker ever made that decision. No union leader ever made that decision. That was the corporate CEO's decision. They decided that, you know what? There's more profit over there. Not that they weren't making a profit here. There used to be this small local department store. It was kind of like on a Kmart, Target level. It was called Clover. It was one of these places that when I moved to Pennsylvania, it's the only place I'd ever seen it, but it was called Clover. And I forget who the parent company, I think Hess's was the parent company. And I remember they closed the doors and the newspaper article at the time was interviewing the CEO who said that the company wasn't making an acceptable profit. And it was one of those things you go, wait a second, you were making a profit? How much, what's the acceptable profit? And, you know, because look, it employed hundreds of people. It served as wages for families. You know, it was an anchor in the community. You know, it served the public good. It created jobs. It paid taxes. It did all, and it made a profit, which wasn't acceptable. And they thought they could make more money by moving somewhere else. These are the decisions these CEOs make. And it's no different with manufacturing. So then they go and they use our politicians, thanks Bill Clinton, of which I was never a fan. The neoliberal trade agenda started under Reagan, birthed with Reagan, completely negotiated and put together under H.W. Bush, and finally signed off by Bill Clinton. Created this environment where, you know what? Workers are pliable. Their workers are disposable. Factories that had been in communities for decades were now closing up. Factories that had been in communities for, you know, there was, you know, where I live in Pennsylvania, there was Carlisle Tire and Wheel. They had been in the location there for 93 years. Tennessee gave them a huge check. And they up and moved. Following the money. So when I hear people saying, well, you know, tariffs pick winners and losers. And you're going to cause a trade war. Let me let you in on a little secret. The working class of this country has been under attack for 50 years. The war has been raging on for 50 plus years. The class war has been raging for 50 years. The trade war is a big part of that. Like it or not, we are engaged in a trade war and we are losing badly. And this is the thing that gets me when people say, well, you know, if you put tariffs on things, it's going to raise the price of things. And you go, okay. And my other favorite, there are no winners in a trade war. Really? That's illogical. There's a winner and there's a loser in most things. Let's say you put a tariff on something that raises the prices 25%. As we know from experience, very often, what most companies do is they absorb a big portion of that. they take a little bit less in profit because they don't want their prices to go up and they don't want people to stop consuming. Because if the price goes high, and this is what we know from, you know, economic models and all that, the price goes up too high, people stop buying. When people stop buying, the company stop producing, and you end up having this problem of having overcapacity, and then you have mass layoffs. That is a problem. Nobody wants that. But the other side of the equation is that all the jobs move to China. Nobody has a job left. We have a whole bunch of widgets that nobody has any money to buy. So you have overcapacity and nobody buying it. And guess what? You're in the same scenario. So by admitting that we're in a trade war, and we have been for a very long time, and Trump talked about this in 2015 and 16, and at the time I gave him credit for it. He hasn't done anything positive on it yet. But if you remember, supposedly, according to him, day one, he was going to label China a currency manipulator. That is part of the trade war. By having their currency lower than ours, it makes imports cheaper and our exports more expensive. That's been going on for years. And again, this is part of the problem with having the dollar as the world's currency. And we could go back to, because I've argued we need another Bretton Woods. We need to have another global summit of how we're going to divvy up trade and how it's going to be done. The fact that the dollar is the world's currency, and as I ticked off a number of companies that are owned by companies in foreign lands, that's because of the dollar being the world's currency. Real simple, real quick, not complicated at all. You buy your ice cream from Ben & Jerry's, which is a foreign-owned company. You buy your hamburger from Burger King, which is a foreign-owned company. You buy your bike from, you know, Huffy, which foreign-owned company. And you go down the list of all of this stuff where everything you buy. You know, look, walk around your house and just pick up things and see where things are made. Almost nothing's made here anymore. So that money, those dollars, they left the country. They went to those companies in those countries. That money has to come back. They're U.S. dollars. So it has to come back. So what do they do with those dollars that we give them for their trinkets? They buy us. They buy our companies. They buy our treasury bonds. They buy all of this stuff. So not only are we losing the jobs, not only are we losing the middle class prosperity that those jobs once brought, we're getting, you know, garbage, and we're giving them the money to then turn around and buy us even more. So when I have these conversations, I had a bunch of them because of that little quick, you know, back and forth I had with David on Friday. Something has to be done. I think he's the wrong guy to do it. I think he's going to booger it up, but I'm scared that he's going to screw it up to the point where we never solve the problem, and it only gets worse. But to say that we can never have tariffs and that it's a horrible idea is just flat wrong. You know, I go back to some of the things that happened during the Bretton Woods Accord, and I think it was 1944. John Maynard Keynes came up with an idea of having a global currency. I think he wanted to call it something like the Bancor. I think it's a gold bank or something. I think that's what it stood for. And the idea was that you would have a global currency, and everybody else's currency would float against that currency. So much like you have, you know, when you go to Canada, it's like a $1.05 or $1.10 in Canadian money for every dollar the U.S. has. Or if someone coming from the U.K., they give us 80 cents and we give them a buck. The exchange rates are what they are. And you set those with that global currency, and all trade is done in that currency so that no country it has to come back to. And what he wanted was a scenario where you had balanced trade, that there were no absolute winners, there were no absolute losers, that everybody focused on domestic consumption, domestic production, and those things that we wanted to trade or could trade or had to trade, we did. And there was a leveling mechanism. And that leveling mechanism was that there would be no trade deficits. Now, we know that could never really happen. The leveling mechanism was, okay, China's got a $375 billion trade surplus with the U.S. There's a there would be a calculation based on how much their surplus was that they would have to then pay to the U.S. to help level that out. Because we've lost millions of jobs. And we've got millions of factory workers and millions of people who had those jobs and families who depended on that, who then have to get, you know, food stamps and unemployment and, you know, Social Security and, you know, Medicaid and go down the list of, you know, heating assistance and school lunch programs and all of that stuff just to exist. And that the theory was is that you have the winning country pay that to the losing country so that they were balanced. So that it would make things cost a little bit more for the winning country so that the losing country maybe would bring them up a little bit so that you would have that leveling so that you didn't have to deal with desperate nations all the time. And the sad reality is any sense on this is just completely lost. And it's infuriating to me to hear people say, well, it's just going to cost us more. It's already costing us a lot more. We just don't realize it. I'd love to hear your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You buy the lower price, better life idea? Or do we need to do something to protect ourselves and to protect our industry and to protect our workers? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1892. That was the day miners in Tracy City, Tennessee, rebelled against the state's convict lease system. Miners had been forced to work side by side with convict labor. The convicts, overwhelmingly African American, were forced to live in deplorable stockade conditions. Their presence in the mines served to minimize paid labor, keep wages low, and stunt union organizing throughout the state. Miners demanded that Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad give them the same hours of work as the convicts. When they refused, the miners marched on the stockades where the convicts were housed. They released the convicts and marched them onto trains bound for Nashville, burning the stockades to the ground. The revolt at Tracy City followed armed uprisings of thousands of miners the previous year in nearby Briceville and Coal Creek. Here, it is thought that the Knights of Labor leaders led miners to surround stockades, disarm guards, and release convicts onto Knoxville-bound trains over the course of several days. By August of 1892, hundreds of miners would confront state forces in armed shootouts across Grundy, Marion, and Anderson counties, releasing convicts when they could onto trains bound for Nashville. Miners were eventually arrested and convicted, but these revolts would lead the Tennessee General Assembly to end its convict lease system 4 years later, making them one of the first southern states to do so.
Well, they brought in the entire state militia. Heavy artillery and Gatling guns.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The newspaper said they won a great victory. Handed out medals for their bravery. They got the convicts out of the mines.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The wall.
So Tom Steyer, billionaire Tom Steyer, announced today a new national initiative. They're going to spend $10 million to try and get 5.5 million people to vote in the next election. We need every person to get out and cast their ballot. We need every person to stand up, step forward, and speak out The new initiative in conjunction with the need to impeach is now the need to vote. And I absolutely, absolutely agree. And what they're trying to get people to do is to commit to cast a ballot, commit to doing it right now. Commit that you're going to, in the fall, on November 6th, march to the polls and vote. And what's kind of sad to me is that, you know, that someone has to spend you know, a boatload of money to just to try and convince us to do something we should do anyway. Because generally, I'm one of the people who says, as my grandfather always said, you know, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. The same thing in this. If he's going to spend $10 million, you know, I always immediately, just viscerally, question the motives. Now, I know this guy, he's a businessman. He's somebody who I believe has the better interest of the country at heart, and Trump is not that better interest. But still, viscerally, I kind of struggle a little bit with it. Just a little bit. And speaking of the moneyed interests, a bus tour is being floated. I guess there's a big bus tour coming. You may remember the Koch brothers, because of the tax scheme that the Republicans ran through, they spent, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $20, $25 million promoting the tax scam. Evidently now, them and their cabal of billionaires that we've created, thank you very much, they're planning on spending upwards of $400 million this election cycle to keep their minions in. And I guess the goal is to hit the road and brainwash the faithful into thinking that the tax cuts that the Republicans ran through are somehow actually good for working people. Evidently, next week there's going to be a group that fired up called the Job Creators Network. They are launching the Tax Cuts Work Bus Tour, going to stop in 33 vulnerable Republican districts and say how wonderful the tax cuts were. Remember, this is just one of those things that, again, back to the money. The Kochs and their ilk are going to spend $400 million this election cycle. Because of that tax break, because of that tax scheme, because of that ripoff bill, the Koch brothers, just the two of them, pocketed $1.4 billion from that one piece of legislation. So you think about the $20 million they spent promoting it, saying how wonderful it was, and now they'll spend, you know, a little bit of that $400 million out of their own pockets. Let's say they were feeling really generous, and they pocketed, they out of their pocket spent the whole $400 million. So you're talking $420 million to promote the tax bill and then to defend all the people who voted for it. They still got almost an extra $1 billion. That is in just a little over a year. What? Almost a 300% return on investment? You put up 400, you end up with a 1.4 billion? I mean, it's just remarkable. And I just sit here and I think about, you know, this bus tour and what they're going to be pushing about how wonderful this plan is. Now, the 20 million long gone. They spent all of that. The 400 million is what they're going to spend on this election cycle. So this tour part of that. But you know, you look at this and what's just amazing to me is that there are going to be people who look at what this tax cut did. 83% of every dollar, we know this, 83 cents out of every dollar of the tax cut went to the top 1%. Any pennies that the working class of this country are getting right now go away in the next 10 years. That's the reality. Corporate tax breaks are permanent. The stuff that they did on you know, the estate tax and all the other stuff, done. No sunshine there. The little bit that maybe you or I may have gotten, and I got to tell you, I haven't seen it. And I've yet to find anybody who goes, oh, it's life-changing. I got 38 cents. The reality is we got screwed again. So I'm kind of curious, and I want to hit one of these 33 districts. And over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be talking about, you know, where they are, because I want to go to one. I want to see what they're going to say, what the argument is for these horrible tax cuts. Because we've seen this movie over and over and over and over again. We've seen it over and over again. We just keep getting robbed blind. You know, the whole neoliberal agenda. You know, birthed during the Reagan years. More tax cuts for the wealthy. Because they're the smart people, right? They know what to do with it. Give them all the money and they'll invest it properly. And I say, yeah, they do. They invest it right. They're smart. They invest it in how to benefit themselves, not society, not you or me. No one's ever given me a job out of the goodness of their heart or their benevolency. They've given me a job because, hey, I can make more money off your labor than if you weren't here. There's the dirty little secret. There's no benevolent employer. There's simply someone who says, you know what? You're worth more to me here than you're not. And the second that you're not worth more to me than you're not, you're not. Seems pretty simple. The day that you cost them money, the day that you're no longer putting money in their pocket, you're no longer there. And it's one of those things where, you know, I'm going to be interested to see where they go with the big tour. So if it's in one of your districts, I would love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Share the thoughts on the big tour. But, you know, the reality is those tax breaks didn't help you or me or any other working person. They helped the billionaires and they helped the big multinational corporations. And sorry, they didn't help Main Street at all. It all went to Wall Street. Quick break. Right back. They're blue for me and you, and I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. Communists, Reds, long have these been the cries of the press and politicians seeking to undermine the labor movement in the United States. Sometimes even labor leaders themselves got caught up in the anti-communist hysteria. And on this day in labor history, the year was 1938. That was the day that the president of the Metal Trades Department of the American Federation of Labor, John P. Fry, gave testimony before the Special Committee on Un-American Activities. It was known as the Dies Committee. Texas Congressman Martin Dies Jr. founded the effort to root out an alleged communist threat in the U.S. In his testimony, Fry alleged that there were 300 CIO leaders who were communists. At the time, the AFL and CIO were two separate organizations. The CIO had split off from the AFL to pursue more organizing in industries like automaking and steel. Even after his testimony, Fry maintained a network of operatives in the labor movement to identify suspected communists. A few days after Fry spoke before Congress, the Chicago Tribune ran a story explaining the perceived communist labor threat. The article declared if the communists in the United States continued to operate as the Communist Party, they would have no influence on American foreign policy in the foreseeable future. But by making themselves leaders of labor and therefore powerful in democratic councils, they can be of immediate value to the Soviets. The paper warned that the communists were hoping to march the U.S. into another European war. The public had little appetite for another major conflict. The charge that the CIO was infiltrated by communists who wanted war took its toll on the radical labor organization, dividing workers by playing into the fears and hysteria of the era.
most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. So the prosecution has wrapped up their case in the Manafort trial. Interesting. Going to see how the defense comes out tomorrow swinging. What will their defense be? Everyone's lying but my guy. And will Manafort take the trial? Take the stand? Will he have the ostrich jacket on? Will he have the satin pants? I can guarantee that's not going to happen. Doubt he takes the stand. Anyway, we're here to share some thoughts on what's going on with the trial and everything else around the nation. Bob Nay, Talk Media News. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
So does he take the stand?
No.
Never?
No.
Not at all? Not going to happen?
No. I highly doubt it.
I wouldn't either.
No, I don't think
but at this point, what's he got to lose? I mean, everything that we hear coming out of there, I don't think the defense really did a good job of discrediting anyone, do you?
No, I mean, I think that the jurors with Gates, I think Gates has been discredited a bit now. The other witnesses aren't. What was the accountant and then a couple other witnesses? There was five. If they really focused on Gates because, look, you know, Gates stole some stuff and he was in the Trump campaign. So if anybody could be discredited a bit, but I don't think he was completely eliminated, don't get me wrong. But yeah. The other witnesses couldn't be discredited. One of the more amusing things is when somebody asked Gates, well, did they threaten you with 200 years? And he said, oh, no, it was 100.
Yeah, that was my favorite.
First 90 are the toughest, Rick.
Yeah, you know, just getting past those first 90.
The last 10, that's a breeze, right.
Yeah, but, you know, look, they had 28 witnesses, and all we talk about are the ones, the accountants.
They got the money. They knew where the money went.
And that's the thing. You know, someone knows where the bodies are buried. And those folks, they sure turned quickly. I think he's going to be found guilty. He should spend probably a good portion of the rest of his life behind bars. And then he gets to do it again in not too distant future, which, hey, fun for him.
Mm-hmm.
Probably couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
I don't think he's going to make it, right? The trial, I think he gets found guilty.
Yeah. So do you think at the end of the second guilty, if that comes around, do you think eventually he flips and goes, hey, you know, I'd like to see the light of day at some point?
No, because they can't give him light of day, and I think his only option is to get a pardon.
Oh, okay. So, gonna go that route. So, do you think the whole comparison with Alphonse Capone and Manafort? Do you think that was code for something?
Well, they're making a point that some people are accepting this, and here's what it is. If this trial ends and there was nothing that was a big bombshell that there was collusion with the Russians and it didn't, you know, if it didn't come out in this trial, then they'll be able to spin the fact of the Capone thing, spin the fact that, look, they nailed him on something that had nothing to do with Russian collusion.
Right.
So therefore, you know, the president's clear. That's what they'll be out there.
Right, but isn't that what the second trial is supposed to bring? I mean, this one was really just about, hey, we caught you laundering a whole ton of money. This is what this is about.
Yeah, and then again, if they do try to cut a deal, then anything he says can be discredited. And the reason I say that's important, this is never going to be decided with an indictment of the president. Mueller will not indict the president. The president will not sit down with Mueller. And it's going to come to, you know, chicken in the middle of the road, you know, and so it's all going to be in the court of public opinion, most likely.
Yeah, and the more we're divided we are, the more that just, I don't know that anyone listens to any of the reason or fact. I think at this point most people are in their camps.
Right. I think so.
And that's kind of scary to me. I mean, you look at this weekend, you had these Unite the Right idiots out, you know, marching around, you know, with their neo-Nazi flags and all that nonsense. And you go, you know, how much crazier can it get? You know, I pine for the boring days. give me some boring days back. I'd like to have a day without having to worry about if there's a Nazi in the streets.
You know, there again, there was the corporate media, as I'll call it, you know, The corporate media invested all this money. They thought there'd be a repeat of Charlottesville, you know. So they gave massive attention. The counter protesters showed there was a good thing there, but gave massive attention to 24 people because they invested all their crews and time there, yeah. You know.
Yeah. And I watched
something happened.
Did you see the CNN woman out there begging someone from the Unite the Right people to talk to her? And they're just standing there hiding behind their flags with their face hidden. Right. No, we don't want to talk to you. And she's like, come on, talk to me, please. It was really It was really quite hysterical.
Oh, yeah, and they got the clock ticking on the money. So that's about what they did.
But you're right. You know, it's you have 24 people that got all that airtime. I keep coming back to that scene in The Blues Brothers. You saw The Blues Brothers, right?
Oh, yes.
Where, you know, he goes, I hate Illinois Nazis, and he drives them off the bridge. Mm-hmm. I'm actually okay with that. I shouldn't be, but I am. Let's move on. Evidently, an FBI agent was fired today, Mr. Text Fingers. I guess he was recommended only to be demoted and suspended for a bit, but they actually fired him, right?
Right. And people, of course, are saying he had the right to the opinion, but they were going to fire him because, you know, he talked related to Trump. In a normal case, this never would have all been brought out. No, never would have.
Right.
The high profile nature of this, you know, threw it all out there. Because today a friend of mine said, well, what happens if down the road Trump leaves and then a Democratic president comes in and they find out that during the Trump campaign, an FBI agent did something similar? And I said, it won't come out. You know, this came out because of a high profile case is the only reason this was even looked at.
So you're saying this stuff has always happened. It was just dealt with internally,
absolutely.
And it was dealt with swiftly and quietly and didn't make the front page of the newspaper.
Sure.
Of course. I mean it's just basic human nature.
It's all internal.
Yeah, I mean, we're living in very different times now, though.
Right. Oh, exactly. Exactly.
It's crazy. Anyway, so I can never say his name. Stroke, I guess? Strosk?
Strock, or
something like that.
I never get it right.
But he's out of a job now, so there's that. Let's move on. I guess North and South Korea are going to sit down with a meeting with an intermediary sometime in September. Is that going to happen?
Yes, and, you know, I don't think this is a bad thing. There, again, the national media has tried to say, well, you know, this is going so slow, and he's building missiles. The point is, the countries have not had communication of any sorts, really, for 70-some years, just sporadically, including with us, North Korea. And so now it's beginning. It's not like Iran, where we have now cut off communication with Iran, obviously, the steps, you know, we took to undo the nuclear deal. This is a deal in a process. So I think it's got to be given time, and at least they're sitting down. This is the third time the two presidents have met from North and South Korea, and, you know, at least they're talking. And if there are some differences, they can work them out versus what we are now doing with Iran.
Yeah, there's part of me that goes, you know, the Chinese are manipulating this whole thing. And they're the ones going, you know, you go sit this down and say, look, we need access to your cheap labor. We need lots of local cheap labor. And so we can, you know, get our production done and keep down the rising wages and all this stuff. Thinking clearly, you know, just on the labor front. That's my view anyway.
Oh, the Chinese go, they're very smart. I mean, they're manipulative. They go from multiple sources. When they wanted to go into Tibet, they moved 3 million Chinese in Tibet. They banned the learning of the Tibetan language. They just committed cultural genocide over there, and they got labor out of it.
No, I mean, that's to me, it's just that simple. And I know nothing is ever really simple. I think it's pretty much, I think to me, the writing's on the wall for that. Let's move along. Big elections coming up here in, 84 days? Not too long from today. You say that the Democrats are running not just on the repeal of the ACA, what the Republicans wanted to do, but actually have some other ideas. What do you mean?
Well, ironically, you know, what started out as an anchor around the Democratic necks, which was, you know, the ACA, also known as Obamacare, which the Republicans went after that, as we know, tooth and nail. And then the Republicans said, you give us control of the government, we will repeal it, we will repeal it. Well, they didn't repeal it, but they actually have done through executive orders with the president some changes, which has obviously weakened it, and a lot of people will be leaving the exchange for cheaper programs, but if you have pre-existing conditions, you're not going to get those cheaper programs. So those plans. Now, the Democratic side has now, rightfully so, raised this issue that, hey, you know, you guys said you're going to repeal it. So the base is a little bit weak with their candidates, Republican base, because they're saying you didn't do it. You had your chance, you didn't do it, now it's here. But the Democratic side is making this a boutique issue, which is really smart, by the way. They're going in, for example, let's take the Attorney General in West Virginia. They're going after him because he filed a lawsuit on the ACA. So did the Attorney General in Missouri. Both of them are running for the Senate. So they're going after them and saying, hey, you filed the lawsuit. Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, he didn't buy into the Medicaid expansion. Well, Republican Governor Kasich did. It's working in Ohio, right?
Right.
So they're going after not just the Republicans have done nothing. They're going after Rick Scott. You did this. So they're picking out candidates and how they're tied. One candidate for the Senate was an insurance commissioner, and he approved a rate hike in the premiums. So they really latched on. Now, don't get me wrong. There's other issues they better get on fire, you know, with very quick. But they've come to realize that there were other issues beyond two or three that they were out there promoting. And this is one. They're getting some traction on it. I don't know if it's too late, but they have certainly, you know, been able to get this out front. And we'll see what they do with it from now to November.
Now, and the Republicans ran not just on repeal, but on repeal and replace. You know, supposedly
right.
They
right.
had the utopian plan. And they couldn't even repeal it. And they've had no suggestions on what to replace it with. And I think, you're right at the very beginning, I think everyone, especially some of my Republican friends, were literally shocked that there was nothing there, that it wasn't even the same bad ideas that they'd had in the past, like health savings accounts and more stuff like that. They didn't even have that ready to go.
Well, look, they did nothing. They did not balance the nation's budget.
Oh, far from it. They went the other direction.
Right. They went the other direction. Right, exactly. And they provided, and the tax relief they provided is not going to get them votes. They're starting to realize that. They didn't repeal and replace. They didn't stop, as they said, you know, the illegals, like they said they would do, because they control both chambers. Now, Mitch McConnell makes the argument that Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, used to make, well, just give me some more votes. People don't, the Senate is controlled by the Republicans. Don't tell me, give me some more votes.
Yep.
You control the chamber. That's the way they looked when Harry Reid tried to say that. And they have failed on all these things. So what does that translate to? The base may not be so excited to run to the polls for them.
Well, let's hope so. I'm hoping they stay home.
If the Democratic side is smart.
I'm hoping they stay home. I'm hoping the Republicans stay home. Because, look, there's got to be some pendulum swing back somewhere towards sanity. Because to me, this, you know, healthcare is the most important issue. Ask any family. They want to make sure that if their kids, you know, go ride their bike down the street and they break both legs, that they're going to get the care that they need and they're not going to have to worry about being bankrupt. That's mm-hmm. just simple common sense. And I think everybody wants a solution to this. Prices are getting out of hand. You hear these horrible stories all the time of families struggling. And, you know, the Republicans have done nothing from the time they took power other than make, as you point out, make things worse. And the people who are getting these micro plans, because, hey, we're making those mini plans great again. Once they get sick and realize it doesn't cover anything anymore, they're going to be bankrupt, and we're going to be right back where we started from.
Well, I mean, not that I count, because no one has any sympathy for me, and I don't ask them to. But right now I have a prescription pending, and one tube is $350. And I don't have health care. I have zero health care. And because the premiums escalated to the point I had to dump it and take my shot. So, you know, I mean, it's just me. Yes, my kids are adults and things, so I'm not asking for sympathy, but there are people all out there, you know, like me and other people, and people with families far worse, would have it far worse than I do, but it's out there. I mean, it's spread across the society. It doesn't say, oh, you're a Republican, I'll make sure you have health care, and the Democrat doesn't. The Republicans have to realize there's tons of Republicans out there in the same boat.
Yeah, and the sad reality is that, unfortunately, you're in that situation. And nobody should be. I mean, we're the wealthiest country in the history of civilization at its wealthiest point. The least we can do is make sure that if you have something that ails you, you get to see a doctor. I mean, if you get in trouble, you get to see a lawyer. I mean, it just seems that simple to me.
Yes, I agree.
It's just crazy. Let's move on. Opioid addiction. I've been saying for a while when it was just, you know, inner city minorities, you know, shooting heroin. Because like when I was a kid, we found a guy. I think I was like 8 or 9 years old. We found a guy dead on the side of the neighbor's house with a needle in his arm. I believed it was heroin, so I was told. Nobody cared about him in the big, heavy army green coat. Nobody cared about him. But now this addiction has hit, you know, lily white suburbs, and we've got Oxy, and now it's a crisis. Now we've got a crisis when just poor people were dying in poor neighborhoods in the ghetto. Nobody cared. But now, crisis, right?
Well, yeah. Well, the article came out today, and it's interesting. Not that there's a correlation with the Republican to the opioid, but there is an interesting fact, that is that more of the districts that are headed by Republicans have some of the highest opioid abuse rates and opioid problems in America. It's all over the country, but rural, south, and also Appalachia, it's out of control problems, and there's a lot of Republicans there. So, yes, it's not just an inner city problem. It's all over the place, and so, people have to realize in the positions of power, they've got to try to do something with this catastrophic situation. So it's not just, yes, the inner city problem.
So is it pain and suffering? Is it a lack of opportunity? You know, have they identified, you know, your average opioid addict? I mean, you know, most of the people who I've known throughout the years who have had these addictions, it started off, again, most of the people that I know personally, so it's a personal story. Most of the people I've known, they got hurt at work. And they got hooked on, Vicodin and Percocet, and then eventually got to Oxy. And then they had to go, look for street stuff because the prescriptions were cut off. Do we know what drives people to this? Do we know what it is that hooks them?
It's a wide variety. It's not just a poverty index. You've actually raised a good point of what's happened. And, you know, for the last 10 years, I've sponsored people in addiction recovery, and I still do it today on an almost daily basis as a volunteer. And, with the cases I know with the opioid addiction, there were accidents, injuries, overprescriptions. People got hooked on them. Then they went when they couldn't get them anymore, and they went into a higher street price for them. And then a lot of the people went to a cheaper product, which was heroin. But of course, it is death and is, you know, massive addiction, instant, almost. So that's sort of the history of it. Yes, it's been used with painkillers and, you know, problems of that nature, injuries at work. So it's not just, you know, the poverty deal in the inner city. It's all over the place for a wide variety of reasons.
It's something's got to be done. And, you know, I tell people, throughout all the years, I've had a couple of surgeries, and I had some work injuries throughout the years. And, you know, doctors were going, here, you know, if you feel uncomfortable, you know, take this Vicodin or this Percocet or, you know, this, you know, they give you the super ibuprofen, like, you know, 800 milligrams. It's just like taking a couple extra. But I never took any of this stuff because I'm always fearful of, you know, once you take it once, that just changes everything. And I'm just kind of crazy about it. But I feel sorry for people. I really do struggle with this.
I have a friend in recovery. He went to the doctor today, and the doctor did not ask him anything, was prescribing a narcotic, and he said, wait a minute, I'm in recovery. I have to have an alternative. They were just going to give it to him.
Yeah.
I mean, these days, you've got to at least inquire.
Yeah. Is there any before I let you go, is there any alternative to the addictive painkillers? I mean, I have some friends who say, well, we should legalize pot because pot is alleviate some pain. And I don't know. I've never smoked it, so I don't know. Is there a non-addictive pain medicine? Is there a treatment? Because, look, I think we're a society today that we don't want to feel anything. So is there anything non-addictive?
There's different levels of what they could prescribe. And here's the problem. Like OxyContin, they were prescribing at such high levels. It wasn't a controlled situation. They were high levels of pills. And then people would take two because two was better than one, you know. And that's a problem.
That is a problem.
Sure.
When you don't bother to follow the basic rules on the bottle. Because, hey, we can't read either, so there's that. Bob, I appreciate the time. Great stuff,
man. Thank you, Rick. Okay, thank you.
As always, our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. The Working People.
on the phone.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day that 35 journalists of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer walked off the job. They represented about half of the newspaper's newsroom staff at the time. The strike started because the paper had fired two longtime employees, drama critic Everhart Armstrong and head photographer Frank Slim Lynch. The two had joined the American Newspaper Guild, a union for newspaper employees that had begun in 1933. Management claimed the firings were due to the two employees' poor job performance and insubordination. But Armstrong had worked for the paper for 17 years, and Lynch for 15 years before joining the union. The Seattle paper was owned by the newspaper giant William Randolph Hearst. Hearst was known for his anti-union, anti-communist, anti-Roosevelt stances. The strike was thus a battle between a few dozen journalists and this national opinion maker. Even though the numbers of workers on strike were small, the cause won the support of other labor unions. The Teamsters refused to deliver newsprint to the Post-Intelligencer. Longshoremen, metal workers, and lumber workers joined the newspapermen on the picket line. The strike wore on for 3.5 months, and the paper was shut down. Many in the public supported the newspapermen. The strikers put out their own newspaper. They called it the Guild Daily. It included updates on the strike, as well as general news and sports coverage. The circulation of the strike paper reached 60,000 a day. Finally, President Franklin Roosevelt won a landslide re-election victory. Perhaps recognizing the mood of the nation was swinging toward the working man, management decided to settle the strike. Today, the Newspaper Guild has 34,000 members throughout the United States and Canada. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
It's an interesting scenario Bob Nay talks about, because, you know, I've known a couple of people over the years who have been addicted to painkillers because of, you know, injuries at work. And I think of one guy in particular who fell off the, slipped off the gas tank of the truck, got his foot caught in between. Just one of the most horrible things I'd heard. He got his foot caught in between the frame and the gas tank. And as he fell backward, his foot stayed in there. And his whole foot wrapped around the tank, and he ended up landing on the back of his neck and cracking a couple of vertebrae. And he was just totally messed up. And you know, his foot was never going to be right ever again. Tore the Achilles tendon, broke a bunch of stuff, and just ripped everything to shreds in there. And they had him drugged, you know, pretty heavily for a while. And you know, the last time I saw him, he was in a bad way. I mean, really, just in a bad way. Because they had begun to cut him off of the drugs, and he was, from what I understand, looking in other places, and it was just a terrible thing. And I don't know what the answer to it is, but I know that I've gone into places, and the first thing they do is they want to give you a bunch of painkillers and all that, and I there's got to be a better way. I'm just not sure what that is, but there's got to be something, especially as Bob points out that, you know, the amounts that they used to give, just outrageous. And just, you know, kind of crazy. And now my fear is it goes to the opposite extreme, to where we, you know, he may need it, and there's no way in a cold day you're going to get it, which forces people into the other stuff. So we're in really very difficult policy terms. But I'll tell you one thing: the companies that make the drugs, they are doing just very well. Thank you very much. Love to hear your thoughts, any stories, thoughts, comments. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any of the first hour of today's program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. As always, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back with our good friend Propane Jane. Stick around.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.